When Swamiji put together these commentaries on the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, it's a whole year program. And at one point, for various reasons, we decided to reorganize the sequence. What actually happened was Swami Kriyananda's birthday is May 19th, and every year on May 19th, or the Sunday closest to it, the reading was, "Why Do Devotees Fail?" And it was so disconcerting that was the impetus to rearrange the commentary. And for a period of time, we had them in a different order. Swami Kriyananda's way was to allow people to, as much as possible, try things out. So he let us try it out, and we did it for a few years. And then he quietly asserted that he preferred the original order, and then it went back the way it was. He had a long rhythm about things. He would let it just be what it was for a while until everybody had settled down. One of the reasons is, of course, that there's a progressive sequence, which if you come regularly over many years, you may hear, or if you read it in the book, you may see it. So now we're at intuition and reason, but we've already done common sense. And it's really, really important that you have common sense before you go to intuition. Because the great death of the spiritual path is intuition without common sense. Saint Teresa of Avila, who was a great mystic saint, one of the work she did was she founded a great many convents. And at the time that she lived, there was a necessity. If you were going to be spiritually serious, you had to really separate yourself from the world, especially women, because the role of women was extremely subservient to their fathers or to their husbands. And the role of women was to keep house and have children. And there just wasn't much freedom for another destiny. So if women really wanted to pursue a spiritual path, they had to separate themselves very strongly from society as a whole. Traditionally, men always have more freedom than women, but especially in those times. So Teresa of Avila formed these enclosed convents, that once you went into the convent, you lived within the confines of that convent for the rest of your life. And there was 12, 15, not more than 20 women as a group, and they would be together for their whole lives. It was a community, a spiritual community. So naturally, Teresa said, great care must be exercised in the selection of those women. You have to make sure that you have the combinations that will work. And what she advised the mothers that set up those convents was, above all, she said, look for common sense. She said, every other quality, including the love of God, can be developed. But if the nun lacks common sense, nothing else will ever happen correctly. So it's important. I was not here, and I wasn't the one who spoke last week about common sense, but I'm just going to assume it in this context. So now we come to intuition versus reason. And part of the reason I introduce it that way is we want to really understand that the opposition is not intuition versus common sense. Because a lot of times people think that the more wacky it is, the more intuitive it must be. Because sometimes intuition transcends reason, that doesn't mean that by definition it must contradict it. And in fact, Swami Kriyananda was very interesting in the way he worked with his intuition, because especially in the early years, and by early I mean the first 25 or so, from the late 60s, you know, into the 90s or so, Swami tended to keep his own understanding, I would say the source of his own inspiration, he kept it a little bit under wraps. And he did that on purpose, because if he had come forth, especially during the 60s and the 70s, when the whole spiritual movement was really, I want to use the word exploding, on the American scene, with almost no subtle understanding of what any of it meant, the game of being a guru was a very popular sport. And there were folks all over the place declaring themselves, and then there were folks all over the place believing them. And Swamiji just didn't want to have anything to do with what looked more to him like a circus than a serious spiritual effort. Also, the kind of anything you say, sir, yes, sir, whatever it is, yes, I'll do it, is not necessarily the attitude that actually builds true self-realization, because true self-realization is the expanding capacity within yourself to see a higher and higher level of truth. And there is this very subtle interplay between the right understanding and respect and relationship to spiritual authority, whether embodied in the scriptures or in a person or in your own peers or in the voice of nature, however it comes, and a strong capacity to stand on your own two feet. When Swamiji was asked what the most important yoga posture was, his response was standing strongly on your own two feet, which, coupled with discipleship, in as much as the path that he was on and taught to us was one of discipleship, it shows you that what we're working with is more subtle than just a blind obedience or absolute rejection that nobody can know more than me. Sometimes I've been in conversations with people who are so fixed on their own inner guidance, I've had to say sometimes, do you think God is capable of only speaking to and through you? Do you think it's even as a theory that someone else could get a message that was also true for you? Are you the only one who can hear? I mean, we fall into that not by deliberately. We're not trying to make misery for ourselves. We just accidentally do on a very continuous and sometimes quite impressive basis. As we just, you know, you get a little over here and then you get a little over here. This is what the process of the path is. But with Swamiji, going back to what I was saying, from the beginning, really beginning of his incarnation, certainly after he became a disciple, certainly by the time he was starting Ananda in the late 60s, and people of my generation met him, and many of you met him at the end of his life, he had a right, he'd earned the right, from lots of experience, to trust his own intuition and to be able to know the truth of the inspirations that came to him. But he was a superb leader, and one of his own rules of leadership in a little book he wrote called The Art of Supportive Leadership, which I highly recommend. It's an afternoon's read in a lifetime of study. He says, and I'm not quoting exactly, but this is the sense of it, it's the last recourse of a weak leader to silence opposition by claiming access to special information that nobody else has, which is you have to do it because Master told me you have to do it. And many, many times in Swami's life, he knew that he was really being guided from a very high level. But if he had said that to us, then all of a sudden our powers of reason, our powers of argument are absolutely paralyzed, aren't they? When a friend of mine took a decision in his life that was somewhat controversial within the community, and he genuinely felt that he'd been guided by God to do it, I said to him, perhaps you could be a little less explicit and perhaps a little more humble in your declaration, because if anybody agrees with you, they have to be against God, which is a very hard position. You can simply say you believe that even, but then we just have a difference of opinion on the matter. But for you to declare it as an absolute fact, you just put your friends in an impossible spot. And Swamiji would never put us in that spot, even though he had every right to put us in that spot, because it wasn't productive for us. So he would say, I've been thinking. A thought came to me. What about this? Do you think this might work? You know, a few of us were discussing. And then he would lay out some idea. And it would just be there. He often had to say to me, because I became, I can be quite emphatic, I don't always take my own advice. Let's put it in the past tense. I have not always taken my own advice. I strive better to do so now. In fact, some of you have heard me say this. All of us who are serious on the spiritual path have had many other kinds of incarnations. I remember very interestingly, this is just a sidelight, but it was so interesting when it happened. I grew up in a family. We were comfortably well off, not by any means wealthy, but my parents were not particularly materialistic. They didn't invest in fine things. Neither of them were raised that way, and they didn't raise us that way. So we had utilitarian things in our household. And after I came to Ananda, I was with Swamiji, and we were just visiting a woman who lived there. And she had a set of very fine china cups. And in my life, I just never drank tea out of a fine china cup. I never went to such a restaurant, and I didn't live in a home like that. So I pick up this beautiful cup, and it's lovely, and I put it to my lips, and very fine china, very thin, very smooth. I actually had an experience of, wow, that feels really nice, you know, on your lips like this. And I said something to Swami, oh, I see why people have things like this. It's very nice. And then he said to me very seriously, he said, before you are willing to think about, you know, turning your back on the material world, which doesn't necessarily mean you go into a cave, but at least in your heart, you're turning toward God and away from satisfaction in the material world. He said, you must have satisfied, at least to a very large extent, all those desires, which meant that you've had incarnations of wealth when you could buy anything you wanted. Because as long as you imagine that if I could have that, it would make me happy, we have to, our karma compels us to keep testing that theory. Nobody ever learns anything except from their own experience. So we have to test that theory and find it lacking. They say that more wealthy people commit suicide than poor people, because poor people always imagine, if I had it, I would be happy, so I will keep trying to get it and see. Wealthy people have it all and realize it doesn't satisfy them. So Swami looked at me and said, first he said, you know, before you come on the path, you must have been very wealthy. And then he said, be very, very careful. You don't want to start down that whole path again, because merely because we have understood it doesn't mean that we're free of the temptation. Because there it was, oh, this is very pleasant. If I had just a little more money, then I could have cups like this. And the only reason I don't have very much money is because here I am living at Ananda, but if I just took a part-time job somewhere else, then I'd have a little more money, then I could buy china cups, and then there you go. There you go. Do you remember the story of the sadhu and the rag? The sadhu, he lives with nothing. He just has two little loincloths, and he's washing one out while it's hanging on the line and it's drying on the rack. And then the mouse nibbles at the cloth, and he thinks, well, I really need to deal with these mice. If I had a cat, the cat would catch the mice. So he gets a cat, but then the cat has to be fed, and the cat needs milk. So he gets a cow, so he can have milk, so he can feed the cat, so the cat can get the mice, so the mice won't eat the loincloth. But then now the cow needs a field where he can have fodder, so he has to buy some land so that the cow can eat, so the cow can give milk, so he can give milk to the cat, so the cat can catch the mouse, so the mouse won't eat the loincloth. But then working the land takes a lot of time, so he needs a wife to help him. But then it's too much for just her, so they have to have children. So now they have as a wife and a children and the cow and like this and like this. And it starts with a teacup. It really does. It starts with a teacup. And none of us are safe. So now we get back. Get back. I put a marker, a mental marker, but let me see if I still have it. I may not. What Swami was, let me find where I was. I've lost it all, so I'll just start somewhere else. I was so sure I was going to keep that marker. Anyway, but when I was talking about how Swami and his leadership and how he gave us the chance to learn, it was very interesting to me in this particular reading when Swami starts talking about intuition. And he has a big book called The Promise of Immortality, in which he wrote at length each of these commentaries half the year. Then he never got back to it, never finished it. But this one he calls How to Relate to a Spiritual Teacher. I mean, the subject is intuition, but the entire long commentary is how to relate to a spiritual teacher. And of course, the Bible commentary is about Peter's perception of Jesus, which is one of that whole cycle in the Bible is one of my altogether all-time favorites. And the part of it that isn't included in the short reading today, he asks, "Who do you think I am?" And his disciples answer in terms of reincarnation, which is a whole fascinating side. It's one of those little bits about reincarnation that when they took all references to reincarnation out of the Bible, they somehow missed a few of them, and this was one of them. And they say to Jesus, "You were this one from the past," and they name all these prophets who lived before, which is a clear statement that they believe that great souls reincarnate again and again. But then Peter answers very differently. So even though that was an expanded answer, nonetheless, it was still in the plane of what people could normally understand. Reincarnation wasn't an unusual idea. You're a great teacher, you've been a prophet before, you're a prophet again, and here we are all together. But then Peter shifts it. And when we go back for a moment, that answer from the disciples was a very reasonable answer, and quite consistent with the scriptures and quite consistent with their teachings, you know, that this is what happens. But then Peter just shifted entirely and perceived the reality of Jesus. And that is a perception that just comes from your soul and is a reality, and this is the important point, that nothing can change. Nobody can argue you out of a perception like that. And what Swami, I believe, is trying to establish here is not the kind of intuition that says, should I, you know, buy the blue car or the green car? Should I go to that restaurant today or this restaurant? Should I call this woman to have lunch with her? You know, not that sort of like trying to sort of know in the moment. He's talking about the kind of intuition that establishes our lives in a certain direction in such a way that it simply can never be taken away from us. And that's why Jesus' response to Peter in that story was, "You are a rock." His name was not Peter until that moment. He received the name Rock in that moment, Petra, Peter. And he was Simon, son of Jonah, and that's how the verse says. But after that, he became Peter. And upon this rock, meaning upon this kind of direct perception of reality that transcends the temporary and steps into the eternal, that's what we have to have if we're really going to be anchored on the spiritual path. And one of the reasons Swamiji was so careful with us never to allow us to fall into mindless acquiescence was because if you're going to mindlessly acquiesce to him, you're also just as likely to mindlessly acquiesce to someone else. There was a period of time, as many of you know, when Ananda was vilified in the legal courts and vilified in the local press because we had this legal action that took place in the Redwood City courthouse. And in the end, these extraordinarily false accusations, we were judged guilty of every aberration that a spiritual leader could be judged guilty of. And it was a time of testing for everyone who lived here. It's one thing to be the darling of the spiritual community. It's quite another to become the black sheep. And it was a very interesting, because I was very involved in all of the litigation and I was privy to many of the private documents. I just knew more. And I knew everybody involved. It was a civil war. You know, the accusations came from people within the community. So I had knowledge of both sides. It was quite a delightful adventure. delightful in the sense of, you know, the soundtrack for it was galloping, you know, it was an adventure. But when people would come to me and want me to persuade them that Ananda was not in fact scum, I wouldn't do it. Because I could persuade you that we're not scum, but then somebody else is going to come and persuade you that we are. The only answer to that is, I don't know, what do you think? You know, self-evidently, my point of view is self-evident. Here I sit, representing this side, completely knowledgeable about all the mud that's being slung, and I just wash it off and keep going. So my point of view is really entirely irrelevant. The question is, what is your experience? And the question, even more deeply, is, have you learned to trust your own experience? And even more deeply, how do you learn to trust your own experience? And how easily are we made insecure? You know, this is a fundamental fact on the spiritual path, because what happens to us is we go along in this, you know, and it seems so real. Who would think it isn't here? It's here. It's real on its own level, as Master puts it. The dream is real on the level of the dream. It's clearly happening, and all of us are experiencing it. We can't just say it isn't happening. And yet somehow something comes to us, and it comes slowly over many incarnations. By the time one becomes really committed to self-realization, this is not your first round. You know, we just have experiences. We have all those beautiful china cups. We work so long and we have a whole set of china cups. A whole set. And we look at them and we hold them and we drink out of them. And we're still unhappy. So we get more, you know, or bigger or better. And we're still unhappy. And when I say unhappy, I don't necessarily mean that we're weeping and wailing. In fact, as Swami said, and it's a very interesting point, we learn more from being fulfilled than from being disappointed. If we're disappointed, we can always imagine, if it would just work out right, I'd feel better. So eventually it does work out. And then we say, this is beautiful, but is it enough? And when that willingness even to consider that what we see around us is but a veneer over something deeper, that's when we suddenly hear. And for all of you, you all know it, something happens. And maybe it's dramatic, maybe it's slow, but something happens that tells you there is another reality. And it isn't that you reasoned yourself to it. Reason can come in and support it. China cups break. They get stolen. Turns out to be a fake instead of authentic. You know, somebody else has a better one. And in the end, I die anyway, and I don't get to take them with me. Reason helps. But reason alone doesn't do it. Because someone tells you, well, this marvelous insurance company, I don't know how long they lasted. You would come to them and you would will your money to yourself in your next incarnation. I don't think it started in America, but it's the kind of thing Americans would come up with. I commend that quality. If there's money in it, we invent it. It's just so fantastic. You know, people figure out what people might want and then they make it. And then they sell it. That's why we're such a rich country. We're so creative in that way. But what a scam. But reason will tell you, somebody will tell you. But when you know, you just know. And that's the rock. And that's the kind of intuition Swamiji is talking about here, versus reason. It's not clear-mindedness, it's not clear thinking, it's not common sense. It's knowing on a level that it doesn't make any difference what anybody says or does or anything, what happens to us, we just know. And whenever any fragment of that breaks through this facade that we're always carrying of personality and thought and mind and environment and all of that, grab it and hold it and put it in your heart and look at it and contemplate it and do everything you can to gradually make that the center of your life. I remember at a certain point when I was living at Ananda in a very impoverished condition by normal standards. I'd never felt even slightly impoverished, except in this one moment. It was interesting. There was actually a time, well, I lived in a little trailer. I earned $50 a month, so which Swami opened. I was working for him. He opened his wallet and would hand it to me, two 20s and a 10, you know, at the beginning of the month, and I kept it in this little jar, and it was always enough. I had no other expenses. It was very easy to have no money. Having a middle amount of money is tricky, because then you can buy some things. When you have no money, you can buy nothing. It's just, it's a very relaxed position. When Nitai left his position teaching school somewhere in Sacramento, this was in the early 70s, and Nitai moved to Ananda Village and started working in the school, started the school there, and he made $25 a month and supplemented it by making incense in Jyotish's little business. And his mother asked him something about his new job and what was he, you know, I'm still teaching, I'm starting a school. It all sounds really good unless you were there and realize he was inside a chicken coop with six children. But anyway, Nitai said, I'm starting a school, I'm still teaching. Oh, she said, what's the salary? He said, 25,000 a year. She said, that's very good. And he said, I hope God forgives me, I just didn't correct her, I just left it. He said his part, she said hers, there you were. But there was a moment when I was living in this small, rather cramped trailer, and I just sat there for a moment and I thought, this isn't good for me anymore. It just like, I need a more expansive reality than this. It just crossed my mind. And I've always known that I was capable of, certainly of making money. You know, I have no formal education, but I just always had confidence. And so it was really entirely and only a matter of money. So I had to think for a minute, you know, should I go out and do something to get money and to fix this? And I thought, but to do that would be to turn my back on my true dharma, which is to live for this path, to live for God, and to serve this work. Now, you know, reason could come in lots of ways. But that was an essential core. That had been a call from God on a level that reason had nothing to do with. And I had done the work to maintain the freshness of that reality and to make that rock really stable. So all I could say was, I can't. I mean, this may be a true intuition that something needs to shift. But I can't shift it at the expense of this much more powerful basis for my whole life. So I just said, God, if you want me to have something different, you'll have to do something. A year later, I had a completely different situation. You know? And what happens from the thought like that is even stronger. Upon this rock, we build the church of our own commitment to God, and no power of heaven or earth can take that away from us. That is a gift, but it's also a decision. It's also a power within ourselves. Once we see it, we recognize this is the most precious child within me, and I must protect it and raise it until it becomes as... until God himself looks at me and says, thou art Peter, thou art a rock. And upon this rock I will build a church of self-realization. It's our destiny. Let us embrace it. God bless you.